This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and we have a lot of different topics for you throughout the week. We hope it will interest you. Harriet Williamson is the producer. Jason Croft is at the controls. And in this part of the show, we'll be talking about sleep. And if you, if I asked you how you slept last night, and if you said, well, maybe you didn't get a very good night's sleep or you didn't sleep enough, you are certainly not alone. Very significant numbers of Americans report some sleep problems, things like trouble falling asleep, waking up during the night, or still feeling tired in the morning. Well, certainly there is some good news to pass along, and that is that we understand sleep and sleep disorders much better than we did even just a few years ago, and there is help available for people who have sleep problems. This morning in this hour of Focus, we will be talking about sleep, and we have as our guest Dr. James Hertigan. He is professor at the University of Illinois, associate professor of clinical medicine at University of Illinois, Chicago, where he's the medical director of their Sleep Science Center, where they provide services to people who have sleep problems, including insomnia and narcolepsy and other topics as well. And certainly these are some of the things that our guest is interested in, things like narcolepsy, restless leg syndrome, which can certainly help prevent people from getting good sleep, sleep apnea, and other sleep disorders. And we are here this morning to talk about the basic subject area and also to answer questions. We are certainly open to questions. I do try to suggest to people that when we have physicians on the program that we can't diagnose over the phone, but we do programs like this to give you a place to start and a place that you can go to get some basic questions answered. So certainly sleep questions are welcome, and I know the doctor will do his best to help you out. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. We do have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that one, and that is 800-222-9455. So locally, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. If you'd like to send a question in by email, you may do that as well, and it's will-talk@illinois.edu. That is the number to use. And Dr. Hertigan, hello.
Yes, good morning.
Hey, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Maybe I ask a very basic question, and I'm sure that we'll start to get some questions here. In fact, I have somebody who is ready to go. One thing that we know is there seems to be a lot of variability in the amount of sleep that people will say that they need. And certainly we know that adolescents particularly can be very big sleepers. And occasionally maybe we meet someone who says, oh, well, they sleep 3 hours a night, and that for them that's adequate and they function perfectly well, which to me is kind of amazing. What can you say about how much sleep any individual needs?
Yes, sure. Well, that does change a little bit as we change as human beings from infants to adolescents to adults. But an average adult should obtain about 8 hours of sleep a day to feel completely rested. We do have a lot of compensating mechanisms to tolerate shorter sleep periods. And if you look at the evolution of Western society, especially the United States, in the last 100 years, we've gone from getting about 8 hours of sleep at the turn of the century, the 19th century to the 20th, to now about 60% of adults or so get probably an average of less than 7 hours of sleep. So we've certainly changed our behavior, but I don't think we've evolved to tolerate that sleep deprivation very well.
And is that simply a matter of people feeling that they have so much to do that they're just having trouble scheduling everything in their life, and sleep is taking a backseat to other things?
Yeah, I think that's the main part of it. Is we're an on society compared to 100 years ago when we were just developing incandescent light bulbs, and of course we didn't have the internet 100 years ago. So there's a lot of on things that we're choosing not to turn off.
Well, we already have a caller, And I think I will just not, rather than making them wait, I'll just go right to them and take this first person. And it's someone who's listening in Urbana, so we'll get them. And it's line number one. Hello.
Hi. Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been diagnosed with restless leg syndrome, but when they were doing studies to check for sleep apnea, both like 3 or 4 years ago and then about 12 or 13 years ago. So I know that I have it, but at that time, it wasn't as so much a problem for me. It's, and I did take medicine for it slightly, but I have other health issues, and I wanted to avoid as much medicine as I could because I was already taking tons of other stuff. I was wondering, are there things in the diet that if I avoided eating them, they might help reduce the legs, restless leg syndromes? Because I'm thinking it's starting to become a problem for me. My husband mentioned that I was doing a lot of kicking the other night and stuff. So is there stuff I can do with diet as before I pursue medicine stuff?
Well, there's a number of non-pharmacological things to try for restless legs. Now, there's two sleep conditions that aren't always related. There's restless legs, which is actually symptoms before going to bed, and then there's something called periodic limb movements, which are actually happening while we sleep, which was probably what your husband's describing, the periodic leg kicking. Restless legs is the inability to fall asleep.
It was mostly before I fell asleep, and I will actually notice it, like, if I'm dozing off, like, say, sitting in a lounge chair watching TV, I'll notice that my arm will jerk or my leg will jerk or whatever. It's often right before I fall asleep.
Yes, so that's a little bit more common with restless legs, but usually it's more than that. It's really an uncomfortable feeling. So it's a feeling where you can't relax, you can't stop moving, you have to rub or massage the legs, there's pins or needle feeling, there's like heat or burning. There's variations to it, but usually it increases as the later the evening gets toward bedtime. And it becomes, you know, harder and harder to actually relax and fall asleep. I don't know if that's consistent with what you're experiencing or not.
Well, I've had issues with sleep for years. I mean, it's one of the ways that stress gets me, as I'll have insomnia and other things. So my sleep patterns are definitely not very good. But I guess my question was, do I avoid any foods, like do alcohol or chocolate, or are there things that can make it worse? Someone mentioned one of those or those to me a long time ago, and I never really pursued it. So I was just curious if there were common foods in a diet that I could try reducing or eliminating. Have you heard of that?
Well, there are things that can make either restless legs or the periodic limb movements worse. And as you've described previously, so high stress, sleep deprivation, too much caffeine, especially close to bedtime, and alcohol can all be offending variables. So anything in excess of normal certainly can make the situation worse. And restless legs or periodic limb movements often have day-to-day variability, so they can vary as much as 50 to 80% from day-to-day, again, depending on these other factors. So I don't think I'd recommend a specific diet or a specific elimination other than, you know, normally, as a rule of thumb, I don't recommend caffeine after about noontime because it does have a variable half-life of up to 8 to 12 hours in different people. And then, of course, alcohol. An ounce of alcohol takes about an hour to metabolize out of our system. That's about a can of beer. So judge that and try to make sure alcohol is metabolized out of your system before bedtime.
Okay. Thank you for the info.
Okay. Thanks. Well, let me ask you a couple of questions. First of all, about alcohol. And I think that sometimes if people are having difficulty sleeping or maybe having difficulty falling asleep, they might think that alcohol in moderate amount might be helpful because it can have a sedative effect. But I think that the problem there is that, yes, initially it can have a sedative effect, but then it can come back around to cause a problem later on.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And the insight is that alcohol does create sleepiness in us, but once it metabolizes, it does lead to a little bit more sleep fragmentation and lighter sleep. So we're not getting some of that deep restorative, what we call slow wave sleep and REM sleep, 2 or 3 hours after we fall asleep. So our sleep is a little bit lighter. And so even though you're in bed for 8 hours, you're not sleeping as well.
The other thing that maybe is worth thinking about is caffeine. And of course, if you're feeling tired and you have to work or you have to drive or whatever it is, you might turn to caffeine as being something that would be helpful. But then that could add to the problem if you're perhaps having difficulty falling asleep. And I'm sure that some people would understand you can't have caffeine and right away get to sleep, but you're saying that for some people it can take, the residual effects of that caffeine can take many hours to work themselves out, so that even if you were having some coffee before noon, for some people that could still be a problem when it comes time to go to sleep.
Yes, absolutely. Caffeine does have a variable half-life. Some people will say, I drink 3 or 4 cups of coffee and I don't have any effects. It's possible they don't have the alerting effects of caffeine, but perhaps the other side effects of caffeine. So, and we do develop tolerance to caffeine over time, and then can have withdrawal symptoms, primarily headaches or precipitation of migraine headaches with caffeine withdrawal. So there's been a lot of, even I think it even made, you know, the Today Show or some, you know, common show recently, where there were brain scan studies looking at the effects of caffeine on our brain, and it profoundly constricts blood flow to our brain, and it inhibits a certain chemical in our brain that leads to sleepiness called adenosine, and you just can't turn off the caffeine effect. So there's actually been some studies, as you might imagine, in the military, looking at the effects of napping versus caffeine versus amphetamines, and trying to optimize shift work and alertness and performance. And caffeine, if you're especially a night shift worker, plays a role in trying to promote alertness, but you have to time it appropriately. There's no substitute that's better than a nap, especially if you can take a nap in a quiet, relaxed, cool atmosphere where you're not going to be disturbed and there's not a lot of light in that room. A 15 to 20 minute nap is stronger than most caffeine pills in terms of that restoration of feeling restored and ready to go again. Mm-hmm. So try to do a little bit of both if you can. I understand caffeine is used in many situations, especially now with the popularity of these energy drinks, but yeah. Be cautious about it.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because products like that seem to be increasingly available and marketed to people, and that's the pitch, is that, oh, I'm feeling a little drowsy, I'm kind of tired, but I need to be alert for whatever, to do my job, to exercise, whatever. And so these products are available now, and they're mixtures of things, and I'm not quite sure what exactly it is that goes into many of these products, although I have looked at the labels of some of them, and in many of them, caffeine is one of the ingredients. I'm sure that using these kinds of products can also have potential for problems.
Yes, certainly. Most of these small bottle energy drinks contain about 200 to 300 milligrams of caffeine. That's extra tall. Not that I know Starbucks very well, but it's about the amount in a Starbucks coffee product. They can be effective in terms of alerting. The problem is they also contain a bunch of sugar, usually as a quick stimulant in addition to the caffeine, and empty calories. So again, be cautious. You're vasoconstricting blood flow to your brain, and it will cause some withdrawal symptoms if you have to stop caffeine after using it for more than 3 to 5 days in a row.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Dr. James Hertigan. He's a physician. He is associate professor of clinical medicine at University of Illinois Chicago, where he is medical director of their Sleep Science Center. And it is one of those places where people can go for help if they have sleep problems, things like snoring, insomnia, sleep schedule disorders, narcolepsy, pediatric sleep problems, and so forth. And if you have basic questions about sleep, maybe you're having some problems and you'd like to have some suggestions, or we can talk a little bit about things that you can do to try to get a good night's sleep, or you want to talk about apnea, whatever, you can give us a call. And we have, in fact, somebody here again ready to go. 333-9455 is the number here for Champaign Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Here is another caller in Urbana, and line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hi, good morning.
Yes.
A question about best strategy for what to do if you do wake up 2 o'clock in the morning, can't get back to sleep. I've heard that it's best not to just lie there, get up and do something, but what are you going to do that's going to make you sleepy and not keep you more stimulated? So what do you recommend for that?
Yes, that becomes a little bit more common as part of our aging process. We do wake up a little bit more as we age, and that deals with something that I'll talk about just for briefly, which is our circadian or biological rhythm, and how to optimize your sleep schedule in and try to synchronize it with your biological rhythm. We have this propensity to want to sleep, so after about 16 hours of full wakefulness, our body is starting to tell us, hey, I'm getting tired, I really do need to start thinking about my sleep period now. So beyond 16 hours of sleep, of wakefulness, pardon me, we need some sleep. So then the question is, when do we sleep? And normally we follow light-dark cycles. So, and it does change, of course, with seasons as we're getting longer days now. But if you're used to falling asleep at 9 at night, for example, you will have a tendency to wake up in the middle of the night. That's called phase advancement. You're probably going to bed a little bit earlier than your biological rhythm is used to. Normally, with the biological rhythm, there's a cascade of hormones that get released. You've probably heard of some of these, including melatonin. Mm-hmm. But in addition to melatonin, there's a number of different hormones. Growth hormone gets released, and prolactin levels and thyroid hormone gets released and is peaked in the evening hours. And then cortisol levels develop and start rising around 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning to kind of wake us up. So we want to synchronize our sleep period with this, what I call a cascade or synchrony of biological hormones that also get released to either help us fall asleep, stay asleep, or wake us up. So be careful about not being on schedule with your sleep. That is, one day you go to bed too early, one day you go to bed at 1 in the morning, and then your body gets confused. So that can sometimes happen. But then what do we do when that isn't happening and we do wake up? You know, we hear a noise, we wake up out of a dream. You know, maybe we have snoring that wakes us up, or sleep apnea, and we wake up at 2 and we're not tired. Well, we're not tired because usually after 2 or 3 hours of efficient sleep, a lot of those hormones that want us to sleep, including what I mentioned earlier, adenosine, has been metabolized. So we're less sleepy. So you're right. You should not stay in bed tossing and turning, looking at the ceiling for hours on end if you wake up at 2 and can't fall back to sleep. It's arousing, it's frustrating, and counterproductive. So a concept called stimulus control is to take that negative stimulus of staying awake at 2 in the morning for hours on end and getting out of that environment, getting out of the bedroom, going to a different room, trying to stay in low light or minimal light, maybe reading, relaxation techniques, meditation, perhaps even, you know, journal writing, something that's calming, relaxing. It shouldn't be cleaning. It shouldn't be eating. It shouldn't really, I usually discourage watching TV, but something that helps wind us down until we feel like, okay, I'm ready to give it a try again, then go back to that environment of the bedroom. Of course, bedroom environment should be fairly cool. You don't want 3 comforters on when it's summertime, for example. And you wouldn't want to necessarily watch TV in bed before bedtime. So you want to do a wind-down routine before bedtime so that you're ready when you go to bed, you're ready to sleep.
But if you were to read or write during this time at 3 in the morning. That does require light. It is not, that's not something to avoid. Enough light to read or write wouldn't keep your melatonin inhibited and all that stuff.
It should be adequate in low, not bright light. Pardon me. If that helps relax and wind down that heightened arousal, so it wouldn't be so bad to read. If it's
reading off an iPad, is that a particularly bad kind of light off of a screen or a CRT or LCD iPad?
No, that typically it's the light off of, used to actually be the old cathode ray tube TVs or certain high bright fluorescent lights that tend to emit a certain wavelength. It's actually in the blue-green wavelength that tends to wake us up a little bit. But there's a trade-off between what do I do at 2 o'clock in the morning to help relax and wind down versus the light exposure that you're going to have with that activity.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And just to underscore something that you said, it sounds as if you talked a little bit about basic, what is referred to as sleep hygiene, so that you want to, it's probably not a good idea to have your bed a place where you watch television. You don't want to work there. Basically, it should be for sleep and for lovemaking, and that's all. And there are some certain things about the room. You'd like to make it cool. You'd like to have it to be dark and so forth. But it also sounds as if real basic thing is, if one could, it would be a good idea to try to get up at about the same time every day and go to sleep at about the same time every day.
That's right. Consistency in our schedule. We are biological organisms that have to be consistent, which is what I talked about with the circadian biological rhythm. And as long as we're consistent, you know, think of it as if you go to bed at 9 o'clock one day and 1 o'clock another day, it's essentially like going to France and back and you know, traveling across country. So that certainly can be challenging.
All right. We have other callers, and we'll talk next with somebody in Champaign and on line number 2. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have a question about Ambien. I've taken Ambien for a long time, over a decade. And now I heard that it has a side effect of increasing reflux. So I'm wanting to get off of it. Do you have suggestions?
Sure. You know, pharmacotherapy for insomnia is not necessarily a bad thing. The real question is, are you benefiting from the medication or not? And if you're not, then you know, we need to look at either alternative medications or alternative interventions for insomnia symptoms. So the most successful therapy for insomnia is long-term, anyway, is non-pharmacologic. But that can be challenging and takes, you know, up to 6 to 12 months to achieve. In regards to Ambien, Ambien has now been reformulated into various different medications. There's now a sublingual Ambien for middle of the night. There's a sustained release or CR form. There's different doses of Ambien. It's now generic, so it's cheaper. But there are other medications and a number of medications in the pipeline in terms of development for insomnia, and I would say you can't isolate a drug and say this is going to solve my problem. It's not. It's part of the package. What I try to tell my patients is, it's part of doing 8 or 10 different things that will help your sleep, and Ambien is just one of those 8 or 10 different things. So it takes a little bit of time to dissect that out, but you know, I can paint a broad generic stroke or paintbrush, if I may, with that, but because I don't know you and your particular situation. But in general, we look at, you know, the root cause of what the sleep issues are, to exclude a primary sleep disorder. either by history or a sleep study, to look at what's been tried in the past in terms of medication and behavioral, what I call cognitive behavioral therapy, that is looking at things like sleep hygiene, the use of light-dark cycles, the use of physical activity or exercise, the use of synchronizing your circadian biological rhythm to make sure that's well adjusted and controlled, and the effect of medications, which can clearly affect sleep also. So that's, you know, we're just touching the tip of the iceberg here. But in terms of trying to come off the Ambien, if we start addressing a lot of those other issues, sometimes I'm successful at, you know, starting with half a dose of the Ambien and working over time with other therapies that are non-drug related, or a substitute. Maybe there's tolerance that has developed, so we substitute and go to another medication with few side effects. The average half-life of a sleeping medication should be roughly about 6 hours, so we look at that. Unless there's middle-of-the-night insomnia, but you can fall asleep but you can't stay asleep, then we look at other medications for that reason. And then we realize that it's, you know, in your situation, it's been 10 years. It's not going to be 10 days where we're going to solve the problem. It is going to take probably multiple months to work on specific goals to achieve the end result.
Okay, and is it, I had just heard on another NPR show that, and I have really bad reflux, that reflux was, that Ambien did exacerbate reflux. Is that true? And do you know the mechanism?
I do not know a specific mechanism. Ambien has been associated with a number of things. Perhaps it was described. I don't know if it's that common. It certainly, other things associated with sleep can lead to reflux, whether it's snoring or a certain body position or other health issues.
Okay. I'll get a reference. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Questions, welcome again. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Ambien is a prescription only medication, so you would have to get that from a doctor. But there are over the counter products that are available for people who have sleeplessness. And I suppose one could even just take some Benadryl. And perhaps get the same effect. But would you say, even for people who are having trouble sleeping and thinking about turning to that they should be careful about that?
Yeah, I am in favor of prescription drugs over over-the-counter self-treatment medications. You know, Benadryl, some people really respond well to Benadryl. The problem is it does have some side effects and a variable half-life, especially in the elderly. So it can hang around up to 9 to 12 hours as we go above about the age of 60 or 65 and lead to some daytime sedation problems, along with the common side effects of mouth dryness and nasal stuffiness and things like that.
Mm. All right.
So
you would say, again, it sounds like you were saying, if someone is really having a problem, a sleep problem, rather than try to treat that themselves, it would be good for them to talk about that with their doctor.
Yes.
All right. I'll tell you what, we have some other callers here, but we'll need to take a short break at this point. We'll talk some more about sleep and sleep disorders with our guest, Dr. James Hertigan from the University of Illinois Chicago. First, though, we'll take a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, we mark the one-year anniversary of the capture and death of Osama bin Laden. Journalist Peter Bergen produced the first TV interview with bin Laden back in 1997 and has written about him ever since. Bergen's new book is called Manhunt, the 10-year search for bin Laden from 9/11 to Abbottabad. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Trophy Time in Champaign. Trophy Time features a variety of advertising items, name badges, plaques, and trophies. They can also design and create unique awards for any occasion. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophies. More information is available at 351-7958.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. Try to mix them up and hope that there are at least a few things that will interest you. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we will talk about innovation and the role of the university. And we'll have two guests, Debashish Dutta, who is Associate Provost and Dean of the Graduate College of the U of I here in Urbana-Champaign. Also, Lawrence Shook, Vice President for Research. And we'll talk about innovation. And certainly innovation is very important for individual companies as they try to move forward and for countries if they want their economies to move forward. We'll talk a little bit about really what it is and whether a university can cultivate that or teach people to be innovators. Then in the second hour, the guest is James Kwok. He is Associate Professor at the University of Connecticut School of Law. He is the co-author of a new book that we'll be talking about. The title of the book is White House Burning, and it is about the national debt, what it is, where it came from, why people should care. You can check the schedule for the rest of the week by going to our website, will.illinois.edu. You can also listen to past programs that way by taking a look at our web archive. You can follow us on Twitter at Will Public Media. You can also check us out on Facebook. In this hour of Focus, we're talking about sleep and sleep problems, and our guest is Dr. James Hertigan. He is a physician. He's Associate Professor of Clinical Medicine at University of Illinois, Chicago. He is also the Medical Director of the Sleep Science Center there at U of I, Chicago, where they try to help folks who have sleep problems, things like insomnia and sleep schedule problems and narcolepsy. He himself is particularly interested in apnea, in sleep disorders generally. He has helped people who have restless leg syndrome. And if you have questions about those sorts of things, you can call us. We have a couple of people here ready to go. And we'll talk next with someone in Jacksonville. And this is line four. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I have, I think, basically two questions. I've recently been diagnosed with sleep apnea, and I also have some memory issues, and I'm wondering, can the CPAP machine have a therapeutic effect on memory problems caused by sleep apnea so that the memory returns to normal? My second question is, can sleep apnea somehow induce leg edema? And also a third question, what about the advisability of taking some sleeping or sleep medication with a CPAP machine?
Well, you're not alone with those questions. I get those quite a bit, actually. And I'll start with the first, if that's okay. In terms of memory problems, sleep fragmentation, insufficient sleep can all lead to memory problems, sometimes a little bit hard to quantify. And hard to actually describe what the response to CPAP might be. If you've been chronically sleep deprived for a while, you might get this awakening experience. A lot of it can be predicted based on what your clinical, how severe you were on that sleep study and what the clinical response was when they applied CPAP in terms of what your sleep did. Did you start getting this rebound effect of REM sleep and slow wave sleep during the titration study, and what your experience has been, even in sometimes recovery of exhaustion and sleepiness can happen very quickly, often within 2 to 5 days of starting therapy. So the treatment effect usually is fairly quick. In terms of predicting will those memory problems get better? I don't know if there's a good predictor to it. There can be ways to try to counter memory problems. It depends on if it's short or long term. Certainly, I think I probably have similar memory problem issues, you know, in just in terms of keeping track of my day and remembering all the things I need to do. So I develop coping skills and lists and notes and, you know, try to compensate for not being able to remember everything that's going on any given day. In terms of the leg edema, so sleep apnea is a phenomenon where the upper airway obstructs and prevents air from getting into our lungs, and it leads to low oxygen levels. And this can be repetitive. I've seen cases where this obstruction of the upper airway has happened 150 times an hour, and some cases as mild as 5 or 10 times an hour. So the degree of oxygen dipping at night often plays a role in the relationship of that leg edema. So in response to low oxygen levels, we release certain hormones in our body called stress hormones that raise our blood pressure and can increase the work effort of our heart. So our heart can enlarge and thicken and essentially go into a little bit of heart failure or chronic heart failure. So sometimes that edema effect does improve through the elimination of those stress hormones that get released that tend to want to retain fluid and improve performance of the heart. The heart starts functioning a little bit better and your blood pressure tends to drop a little bit. So hopefully some of that will go away. It depends, again, on how long the sleep apnea has been present, how severe it's been, how low the oxygen level has been going, and are there other health issues such as underlying hypertension or diabetes or heart disease that may also be contributing to some of this swelling or edema of the legs.
Yeah.
Yes?
Well, I mean, I have no heart disease, according to my doctor, and I also have excellent blood pressure, and so I don't know if that would be relevant to your answer.
Sure. Yeah, well, it certainly could be a retention effect from, you know, just retaining salt from, again, kind of a stress hormone release factor.
I am about 80 pounds overweight. Would that help if I take off the weight, specifically in the context we're talking about?
Oh, yeah, it probably would also get rid of your sleep apnea. As a rough rule of thumb, there's been a number of clinical studies that look at how much weight you have to lose to eliminate the sleep apnea or at least reduce it by about 50%. And the literature would suggest that a goal of about 20% of your current body weight to lose that 20% would have a significant impact on the sleep apnea in terms of severity or perhaps eliminating it.
Oh, okay. And then what about the sleeping pills and CPAC? And maybe what brand might you recommend or not recommend? I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I'll sometimes use sleeping pills in the sleep lab just because I know some people are not going to sleep well hooked up with a bunch of wires in a foreign bed being watched on a camera. So just to get a good result, and there are several medications that appear to be reasonably safe in people with sleep apnea. The rough rule of thumb with that is that I'll use it long-term in some individuals who just struggle with sleep. There are, of course, are people who struggle with that CPAP device and have a hard time either falling asleep or wake up and then can't fall back to sleep.
So, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, so some of the newer, shorter half-life, again, I refer back to that six-hour half-life medication that's not going to have daytime carryover effects and that they tend to have less effect on our breathing mechanism, should be reasonable. And the generic names, well, I'll give you the trade names. We talked about Ambien with another caller. That's one of them. Another trade name is Lunesta. Both of those have been shown to be reasonably safe at low doses in patients with sleep apnea.
Very good. Thank you very much for your information.
All right, thank you. And just to, for people to make sure they understand what it is, some of the things you've been talking about here, particularly the reference to the CPAP device, that essentially what we're talking about here is a problem where people's airways are obstructed or they have difficulty breathing when they were asleep that results in continually waking up during the night. They might not even know it, actually, but they're continuing to wake up. And so you get very poor quality sleep. And so you might have people who are just exhausted all the time or very tired in the morning and maybe don't know why. If they have a partner, that person would know why because they're also always being awakened through the night. So what we have here is a kind of device that people can wear It's a plastic sort of mask that they wear over their face, and what it does is it gently provides an airflow, and that helps the breathing passages stay open, and people don't have that problem. And I guess there are a lot of people who just by doing that, by using that device, have been helped, and so they manage to actually sleep through the night and sleep just fine, and they learn to sleep wearing this thing, and it's can be very beneficial for a lot of folks.
Yes, absolutely. It's gosh, there's millions of these devices now prescribed on a yearly basis in the United States. It's estimated that about 60% of the U.S. population is now overweight, with 30% being obese. Weight is a big driver of getting sleep apnea. Mm-hmm. It can vary between ethnic groups. You know, some ethnic groups cannot tolerate the weight gain of, for example, a Northern European individual can tolerate a little bit more weight gain than perhaps a East Indian individual. But again, the device is essentially positive pressure, airflow, keeping the upper airway open and eliminating the oxygen drops that occur.
Yeah, and but just to, again, to underscore what you've said, it seems that one of the main factors that you look at is weight, and that there will be people who are having difficulty with apnea, that if you can get them to get to their ideal weight, that might indeed take care of the problem, or it certainly would help.
Yes, absolutely. It's probably the most important intervention, probably one of the most difficult but more important interventions, is that weight loss.
Yeah. We have some other callers here. Let's get to the phones back again, and we'll go to line number 3, Champagne. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have been prescribed with mild sleep apnea, and I was prescribed a CPAP machine, and I did get through the trial compliance period, but I hate it so much I haven't used it since. And the doctor said he wouldn't have even prescribed it except that I have some hypertension problems. I'm not particularly overweight. I'm maybe just on the border between normal and overweight. But I was wondering if one of those snoring devices would help, because they thrust your jaw forward, which holds the airway open.
Yes. Really, the mild sleep apnea individual has a lot of choices. Those snore devices, and I call them mandibular advancement devices, as you described, they're advancing the lower jaw, usually against the upper jaw. And there's probably over 100 different devices out there. Some are better than others. Some are certainly much more comfortable than others. They usually involve a custom fitting through a dentist. There's usually 3 to 4 fittings required, and if you have a bed partner, they're one of the best people to gauge whether it's working or not by looking at, you know, snoring and patterns of breathing at night. Many of these are adjustable through a screw turn device, so you kind of turn a little adjustable screw, and that slowly advances your jaw. The rough rule of thumb is that you need to probably protrude the lower jaw to about 60% of maximal protrusion to achieve an effect as far as eliminating or significantly reducing the sleep apnea. But so finding a good dentist is key. Getting it paid for, it can sometimes be a challenge from insurance companies. Making sure whoever you find in terms of the dental field has the experience and is knowledgeable on these devices, something that you can buy by mail order or buy at Walgreens that you boil and put in your mouth, probably is not going to be very successful in eliminating the problem. So the cost often runs in the $1,000 to $1,500 range after including the multiple visits required and the fittings. But many people tolerate that better than CPAP, and I certainly have a lot of CPAP haters out there in my clinic. So a little bit of weight reduction, positional training might be effective. About 50% of patients with sleep apnea are positional. That is, they're often worse when they're laying flat on their back versus their side, and trying to do positional training can help. Sometimes I'll refer people to ear, nose, and throat doctors if there's a clear anatomical obstruction that might be amenable to surgery. Sorry for cutting you off. You had a question.
I just said I never sleep on my back, so that's not the problem. Are you still there?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes,
yeah.
Go ahead.
It was so silent. I'm seeing somebody for the sleep apnea, Dr. Shake. I forget what the specialty is called. So you're saying that he probably could not help me with the dental device? I'd have to go to a dental specialist?
Well, if he has experience, there's some sleep specialists who do also have an expertise in this. I'd certainly ask him if that's an option for you. You have to have pretty good teeth, you know, because it's pushing against the upper jaw, so you have to have your original teeth, and they have to be in pretty good shape because it's creating a little bit of tension on your teeth. But a dentist can take a look at that also. But certainly ask your primary or your sleep physician on what their thoughts are on that option for you.
Okay, thank you.
All right, let's go to another caller here. This is line one. This is also someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to ask you, mentioned that you didn't care so much for over-the-counter remedies. I've been using melatonin from time to time, and then sometimes a little more regularly, and it works much of the time. Occasionally, I tend to wake up 1 or 2 in the morning and then have an hour or so where I have to just do something quiet, and then I fall back asleep. So I just wondered what you think of melatonin and whether you think that's a problem using it on a regular basis.
Yes. Well, so that may be a circadian rhythm issue rather than an insomnia issue. And melatonin's much more effective for circadian rhythm conditions. For example, I'll commonly use it for people who are flying long distances and are going to experience jet lag, especially if they're going through, you know, 8 or 10 time zones, and they're going to really struggle if they're going to India, for example, or China. So it's not a bad thing. As far as sleep inducing and maintaining sleep, it's fairly weak, but can help some individuals. Melatonin is not well standardized, so it may have different variability depending on where your source of melatonin is coming from. Usually my recommendation is to not go more than about 3 milligrams in terms of the dosage.
Yeah, I think it's a 3 milligram dosage. I tried half, cutting the tab in half, but it wasn't effective regularly. But 3 milligrams you think is okay without?
Yeah, I think that'd be perfectly fine. I don't anticipate a lot of side effects for you with the melatonin.
What are the side effects to be aware of?
Well, most of these have been studied, unfortunately, in rats. So, so I don't, you know, the human, there are prescription melatonin products out there, actually, and they've certainly done clinical trials, and they've found very few side effects other than the obvious, which is sedation. So I wouldn't anticipate a lot of side effects. In high doses in rats, it did seem to cause some carotid vasoconstriction, but I don't think it's relevant for humans.
Okay, thank you.
All right, and we'll try to get one more here very quickly. Also, Champaign, line two. Hello.
Good morning, and thank you. Yeah, I have a question and just 2 comments on previous callers.
Well, maybe you can give us a question. I'm not sure we could take the comments, but go ahead, please,
okay,
with the question.
Okay, the question is, I've been on CPAP for quite some time, 11 of pressure. And a side benefit I've noticed is that my gastroesophageal acid reflux problem was completely eliminated by using CPAP, and I don't need to use any acid-suppressing medication. Could it be that the change of the intrathoracic pressure on CPAP versus having severe apnea, obstructive apnea without CPAP, would there be a physiologic reason for there to be a benefit in the acid reflux? And that's my question.
Oh, that's an interesting question. What do you think, Dr. Hergen?
Yeah, well, and that has been described and actually studied in terms of, imagine being in a study where you have a tube going from your nose into your esophagus and your stomach, and it's looking at the pressure differences while you're sleeping. And as you can imagine, if you're obstructing the upper airway, you're still trying to breathe, and that does create negative intrathoracic pressure changes. You must be well-tuned into the jargon of the medical literature, but you're absolutely right. Some people do improve significantly in terms of that acid reflux phenomenon. Without the need for medication, and glad to hear that that has helped. It doesn't always solve the problem with some individuals, but I'm glad it's helped you.
Well, we're at the point where we're going to have to stop, and I'm sure that we could take other questions. I do know that for people who have sleep, basic sleep questions, there's a lot of information on sleep available on the Internet. So if you have Internet access, you can do a search. And then it sounds as if you would say, doctor, that probably one thing that people should definitely do is, if they are having sleep problems, is discuss that with their physicians, their primary care physicians, and they're fortunate enough to have one, and see what can be done, because there certainly is help that's available.
Yeah, absolutely right. There's always the fear is there's no help for my problem, no solution, but most sleep symptoms have solutions, and I guess that's my mantra, is talk about them and find out what they are.
There, we'll have to leave it with our thanks to our guest, Dr. James Hertigan. He is an associate professor of clinical medicine at University of Illinois Chicago. He's also a medical director of the Sleep Science Center there, U of I Chicago. And thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.